Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today we'll discuss the attack against public sector unions with MSNBC's Ed Schultz, issues at the Department of Defense with AFGE DEFCON Chair Don Hale, Vice Chair Patty Vyers, and Marine Corps Council President Brian Leonard, and the one-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act with Families USA Executive Director Ron Pollack. With me now is Ed Schultz, host of MSNBC's The Ed Show. Ed, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you. Thanks so much.
So what are your thoughts on the assault against unions in the middle class in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's part of a larger picture. This has been the playbook for the Republican governors that have gotten together. They want to attack wages. They want to attack the middle class. They want to balance the state budgets on the backs of those who are vulnerable and don't have representation. And the best way to make sure that they don't have representation is to go out there and destroy unions, knock out collective bargaining, attack public education, attack the public sector. And what is so inherently wrong about all of this is that they have delivered tax cuts to the top 2%, delivered tax cuts to the big corporations, and there's just a real grave inequity when it comes to sharing the burden. And when I've been on the road, that's really the phrase that I hear a lot of from Americans is share the burden. And what's interesting now is that there are numbers out there, consistent polling, that the governor of Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and New Jersey, they're all slipping in the polls. And they are really reaching too far, and the people are responding to it. So this could be a real political opportunity for the Democrats. And by default, the president could, in some key states, the ones that I named, especially Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, these are key swing states in many respects for Obama's reelection. These guys are shooting themselves in the foot, and President Obama and his reelection team could be the beneficiary of all of this. They're going to be able to go out on the campaign trail and say, you saw the Republican radical agenda. They tried to take X, Y, and Z away from you. We're not going to do that. We're about investing in America. So I think the narrative is being played out very well for the Democrats right now.
I've heard a lot of people ask the question, how does stripping collective bargaining rights from an employee somehow balance a state's budget?
Well, first of all, when you have an opportunity to bargain collectively, it's strength. And you can go in and you can get a better health care package, which is fair. You can get a better retirement package, which is fair. You can get better wages. You can recognize teachers who have invested in their careers, who have advanced themselves and produced. But these governors have come in, and they have broad-brushed public education. And one of the reasons why they're going after public education, it helps them on both ends. Number one, it helps them cut the budget right away because they can broad-brush. It affects every district and every county in their states. And also, they can push privatization, which the Republican agenda is truly all about. So across the board, the easiest target for all of these governors is education. It's easy to vilify. It's easy to find statistics that aren't working. It's easy to go in and pick on people that don't have the representation as far as the population is concerned. You can pick on minorities because they don't have any money or political pull. And so collective bargaining really is the benchmark and the foundation which supports wages across the board, whether you're in a union or not, whether you're involved in collective bargaining or not. And I think that the Republicans have recognized that this, once they have power in both the House and the Senate in their state legislatures, you know, they can fast track this agenda. And I think we're seeing, well, the demonstrations, the pushback in all of the states.
With that, with the demonstrations, with the pushback, do you think that some of these governors and states that you mentioned earlier, like Michigan and Ohio, et cetera, will tread more lightly going forward, or do you see them just making an all-out push on this?
No, I don't think they're going to back off. I think they're willing to go make the case. They have drawn their line in the sand that they're anti-union, that they're anti-collective bargaining. They've shown that in the way they've set up their tax structure. I mean, what this governor in Ohio has done is borderline unconscionable. After what we've been through on Wall Street, we did this story last night on the Ed Show. After what we've been through on Wall Street, this guy wants to take liquor revenues, stick them on Wall Street, and try to make money off it. All he's doing is lining the pockets of his buddies on Wall Street so he can get reelected. Instead of playing it safe and conservative with the state's money, he's really putting the taxpayers at risk for his own advantage. And, oh, by the way, he's getting rid of the creative economic development program in Ohio, which was run by the state, and turning it into a privatized effort of Jobs Ohio, and the governor named himself the chairman. I mean, how heavy-handed is that? And they want to know why these people are falling in the polls? They're falling in the polls because they're driving this country to a, you know, to America situation, the haves and the have-nots. So, look, they all made, you know, campaign promises to make the tough decisions. But when you start taking away from middle-class families, when you start taking away from people and giving tax breaks to the top 2%, that's what this is all about. This shared sacrifice is not there.
This is AFGE's Inside Government. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and I'm speaking with MSNBC's Ed Schultz about the attack on the middle class in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Ed, why is a middle class so important, so valuable to this country and our future successes?
You have to have a strong portion of the population with discretionary spending power. Discretionary dollars run our economy. And if you don't have discretionary dollars, which the middle class has had for generations in this country, you're going to run into a real economic problem. We're seeing it right now with high unemployment. Who knows what the number is? Labor Department says just under 10%. Every time I say that on the radio or TV show, I just absolutely get pounded with response from viewers saying, no, it's 15 or 17%, plus the ripple effect. And we're supposed to accept this new normal. We do not have a tax problem. We have a revenue problem. We have outsourced so much in this country, in our economy, which has attacked middle-class jobs and middle-class incomes. These are the jobs that have been shipped overseas. These folks have not been able to recycle back into the economy. We've lost our manufacturing base to any competitive advantage. And this is the new normal. Well, that discretionary income, our economy is a long way from bouncing back unless you reinvigorate the economy and get a better employment number and start manufacturing goods again. But when you've got an attack on labor, when you think someone who manufactures something is making too much money and you can do it somewhere else, and you lose your economic loyalty to the country, there's a downside to all of this. And we're going to lose our middle class. And in fact, it's going to take, years for us to recognize what we've done. You have to recognize the problem first. Then you have to have a plan to fix it. And then you have to act on it. And we're not doing any of those things. And President Obama wants to, but the Republicans don't see it his way. And this is what the gridlock is all about. What these Washington politicians don't understand is that their gridlock is hurting families. They don't want to give. We're ideologically stuck in the mud. They don't want to give in on anything, and this is a real travesty. And now, of course, you've got Citizens United that ruling with unlimited funds coming into campaigns. Who knows where this is going to end up? The Republicans are sitting there thinking, well, you know what? We don't have to budge. We got tons of money coming in. We got the advocacy groups with unlimited funds. This ruling by the Supreme Court, we could just stick our ground. We'll get what we want. There's some pretty dangerous stuff going on, I think.
In terms of national politics, as it relates to the situation in Wisconsin and some of those other states, would you have liked to have seen more of a national response in support of the middle class workers?
Well, you know, yes, I would have. And I still would like to see more involvement by the National Democrats on this. But I think this happened so fast. You know, Harold Schaitberger, who is the head of the International Firefighters Association. You know, when I was in Wisconsin, this was about over a month ago, he says, Eddie, I'll tell you what, he says, this is coming at us fast and furious. And it caught a lot of people off guard. And I think behind the scenes, Republicans had a game plan of what they wanted to do once they got in. And this is how they wanted to do it. And there's a lot of coaching going on. You know, you can't tell me that it's a coincidence that all of these governors just happen to be attacking the same things. This is part of their game plan, their playbook. But it happened. It has happened so fast, and it's been so radical. It has awakened a sleeping giant in this country. And ironically, they went after the birthplace of labor, which was Wisconsin. So I think that actually played into the hands of the unions, played into the hands of our show, because it helped shed a light on it. And I think that the conversation is right now in this country that it's the have and the have-nots, and we don't want it. But I do think, and getting back to your question, I do wish that we had had more involvement by national Democrats, and I think there's still plenty of time to do it, and I think it's going to be crucial. I think this is the narrative for 2012. Whose side are you on? Are you for the workers, or are you for the top 2%?
And finally, Ed, what do you think President Obama's greatest challenges are going forward? It seems as if he's confronted with one unexpected crisis after another.
Well, moving forward on a number of different fronts, I think that the base, which he has frustrated, health care is 1 year old today. We're going to do a story tonight on the show about all the outrageous comments that were made a year ago when the health care bill was passed and all of the fear-mongering that has taken place. None of it's come to fruition. So the president, he's driving a steady ship with as many things that are being thrown at him. But I think he is going to be able to go back and say we have made movement, positive movement on the progressive front. It may not be as the way you want it, but this is how Washington moves. I think the base is going to understand the obstruction that took place in the last session of Congress. I think these Republican governors have absolutely taken the mask off the real Republican Party, which I think is going to motivate a lot of basers. So I think the president, you know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I think that he will be able to come back and get a good portion of his base understanding. May not be with the same excitement that they had before, but understanding that what's at stake here is some real grave consequences. I think the president will have labor. He will have wage earners. I think that he will be able to make the case to independent voters that the Bush tax cuts, the Republicans got exactly what they wanted. The Republicans are developing a ledger right now in the Congress that they are not focused on jobs, that they are going the social agenda, that they're doing ridiculous things by trying to defund NPR. I mean, come on. That's not where the unemployed is. That's not where small business is. That's not where the taxation of the country is. And I think the Democrats will be able to bounce back with some good, consistent conversation with the American people and a better priority list.
Ed Schultz, host of MSNBC's The Ed Show. Thanks so much for your time today, Ed.
Jason, good to be with you anytime. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll hear from AFGE DEFCON leaders Don Hale and Patty Byers, and Marine Corps Council President Brian Leonard.
Looking for a new computer, TV, or home appliance? Purchasing Power has a hassle-free way for you to buy these items through easy payroll deduction. You can get the new Dell Inspiron 15-inch laptop for just $30 bi-weekly. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com. AFGE members are eligible for a 10% members-only discount for a limited time. Sales tax may apply.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and we're joined by Don Hale, AFGE's DEFCON Chair, Patty Viers, the Vice Chair, and Brian Leonard, Marine Corps Council President for AFGE. All three of you, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jason. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks.
So, Don, let's start with you. AFGE recently pulled out of talks on the Department of Defense's personnel system changes. What happened?
Well, let me give you a little history, if I could. The 2010 National Defense Authorization Act authorized DOD management and union officials to develop a new personnel system or portions of a new personnel system. So it took a while for us to get going, and we started it off by a big conference out in Los Angeles. Well, as you know, as federal employees, we have to be granted official time to do our union duties. So at this conference, we had initially some problems with an activist at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. We eventually worked those problems out, and we had a great conference. Everything was really going pretty smooth. I think that we were developing a very good working relationship with DOD management officials. So the process continued, and from the big conference, we broke down into three different design teams. When we were developing these design teams, I asked the program manager, Mr. John James, if we were going to have any difficulties with having our activists released from their duty stations. And he said, "Don, you give me the list of activists and I'll make sure that they're there." So I said, okay. We went out, we solicited volunteers, and one of the people that was selected was a nurse from Offutt Air Force Base, Julie Sheehan, the same individual that we had problems with earlier. Offutt management officials were refusing to allow her official time to participate in these design teams. We waited until the very last minute to do whatever we could to get her to attend. Finally, at the last minute, after she was refused official time, she requested annual leave. And believe it or not, these people actually granted her annual leave. They wouldn't allow her to participate in a union activity, but they granted her annual leave. So we paid for her to attend the beginning of this conference. And once again, we went to Department of Defense officials and said, we want this activist to be put on official time. They couldn't get it done. This was being stopped by the Offutt command at their clinic. 2 weeks ago, I thought that I had made them more than a reasonable offer. And that offer was, let's let a third party decide this. Let's go to binding arbitration, expedited binding arbitration. You present your case, Air Force, and we'll present our case, because the law was in our favor. We weren't asking anything except for the law to be applied. I thought it was an easy out. I thought there was no way they wouldn't accept this. Lo and behold, at the last minute, they refused to accept it. There's been intervention by congressional people, a couple senators. Our national president, John Gage, tried to intervene, and they still refused to allow her to participate. So reluctantly, very reluctantly, we decided an injustice for one is an injustice to all. And we said, if Julie Sheehan cannot participate, then the rest of AFG activists will not participate. Do it yourselves.
And how did DOD respond to AFGE's decision to withdraw?
They haven't responded. There's been no communication since I haven't had any communications with anyone from DOD. They reconvened the design teams yesterday, and we still haven't heard anything from DOD.
So then what are the next steps?
Well, the next steps is we've filed unfair labor practices, we've filed grievances, and we're going to litigate this. We're going to litigate it, and we will not be back at the table until our sister's there with us, and we will walk through that door hand in hand.
Patty, you're obviously familiar with this situation, too. What are some of the ways the employee was being targeted by the agency?
Well, they started targeting her and her performance. I know there were several times when she was not released to participate in bargaining their local contract. They said she was too vital. She works as a in a clinic for well children. And although, you know, they're not sick children, she might run into a sick one because they're coming to the well clinic, but apparently they're overstaffed. So this is clearly targeting, an activist who, by the way, organized, you know, an 800 people in that, got them to vote yes for union, and also organized her professionals at her, clinic. The professionals voted to join the union as well. So, you know, it's clearly evident that, you know, management gets the union they deserve. And sometimes there are best organizers, as is clear in this Offutt case.
This is AFGE's Inside Government. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola. I'm speaking with AFGE leaders Don Hale, Patty Vyers, and Brian Leonard. When we're talking about this situation with a targeted employee, how does AFGE respond to those types of situations when an employee is clearly being targeted simply because of union activities?
Well, we take advantage of every avenue available to us. Right now, we've got, as Don said, grievances are getting ready to go to arbitration. We litigate it. I mean, and we come to the aid of those members and activists in particular. We don't leave anybody behind. You know, that's just how we are. That's just how union is. You know, we have various goals and things, and obviously we wanted to be in these design teams because I was a union co-lead for the performance management team. We wanted to be there. But it really makes you question when they won't release your employees, whether they really have your best interests at heart in those design teams anyway. So.
Now, Brian, in a situation like this, it's clear that the managers want to select the union participants. Does the union have an opportunity to select the management participants?
Absolutely not. That we have, each team has the ability to pick their own members. And as Don pointed out, that was a concern of the unions from the very beginning, that we wanted to make sure we had the correct activists. We had a discussion last night among ourselves about the actual management participants that were there, and we felt that they really didn't get a good cross-section of the available managers. The vast majority of them are labor relations and human resource people. Not that they don't have a part to play in that, but not enough first-line supervisors, not enough people that actually manage employees. And that's a trend that we see all the time when we bargain with the agency. This wasn't necessarily bargaining. It was an opportunity for us to work together as a team. And we, as Don stated, we were starting to build from the conferences and starting to build some goodwill. But it was clear that they had their own agendas, unfortunately.
Do you think that we know that the situation here is because of one employee, but do you think that's really the reason, or is there possibly a deeper meaning here?
Most certainly, if you just look at what's going on with our brothers and sisters in the private sector in Wisconsin and in the state and local governments, this is clearly an attack on working people's and in particular unions. It's a control issue for them. They, you know, working for DOD, they're used to giving orders and people jump and say yes, sir, and they don't like to be questioned. And we are clearly under attack because of our activities as union reps, and this is another opportunity that they're taking.
Well, for me, I think it's, Jason, I think it's a culture issue within the department. As Brian said, it spreads out, you know, across what's happening now across the country. But it's very disappointing that the department is acting the way they're acting based on, you know, President Obama's executive order on, you know, labor management forums. The Congress giving them these flexibilities and saying, work with the employees, work with the unions, you know, and kind of guiding them into a, you know, treating us as almost as equals anyway. And so, you know, I don't know how we fix it. You know, it's got to be a culture. It's got to be something that we talk about. And it's got to be soon. We haven't got much time left before, you know, these flexibilities could go away.
Don, I'm sure that the creation of labor management forums is something that's very exciting to hear President Obama when he initiated that. What are your thoughts on that now, given this situation?
It's one thing for a president to issue an executive order or to have a plan that sounds all punky-dory and all that Pollyanna stuff. The reality is that these labor management forums have really done nothing except waste a lot of time. The purpose of these forums was to have pre-decisional discussions. And every day there's somebody in DOD making these major decisions without any pre-decisional involvement. We've just been notified in the Army, for instance, that we're going to take like a huge personnel hit. At West Point, where I work, we're going to lose 73 positions. We're notified after the fact. We never had an opportunity to try to come up with any efficiencies to help them meet their budgetary needs. Nothing. So the labor management forums is something that's being done for management to check the box. Yeah, we've spoken to the unions. Yeah, we're doing this. But is it being done with the intent that the president had in mind? No way, no how.
So talk about then the importance of having true pre-decisional involvement in a situation.
Look, we take our jobs very seriously, and there's nobody that knows how to do this work better than we do it. If just once before my career is over, somebody will respect the fact that we have ideas that could make the Department of Defense better. Ideas as American workers. This isn't a union gig. This is about protecting this country and doing what's right. And we just want an opportunity to be able to do that. In cases where we did have that opportunity, when we were struggling with A-76, for instance, those installations that were part of the process came up with efficiencies and were successful in a lot of A-76 cases. They just need to give us that opportunity.
What will leaving the labor management forums now do to your relationship to DOD?
Well, we're not leaving the labor management forums, okay? We're leaving the design teams. There's two separate paths that's working there. So we have no intentions on leaving the labor management forums. We're going to push to make it more substantive, you know, to make it more meaningful down the road is what our goal is.
Now, shifting gears for a minute, the Army recently decided to halt the illegal conversion of civilian work to private contractors. Talk about this move.
That's what the Army says. that's what their press release says. You know, the reality of it is that there's no money. It's not like all of a sudden the Army is going to eliminate these contractors and bring on federal employees to do that work. And I'm chuckling because just last week I got a phone call from our civilian personnel department where in our medical facility, we have a hiring freeze. Okay, so when they say they're bringing stuff back in and there's a hiring freeze, you don't have to be real smart to understand that just doesn't work. So they can't fill this position, so they call me and they say, hey, Don, we need to get this work done. We're going to get a temporary contract. Well, needless to say, I sort of flipped out a little bit and blew a head gasket, and there is no contractor doing that work. But it's the Army says one thing in the newspapers and live another life at the installation level.
Yeah, and this is DOD-wide, Jason. This is not just happening in the Army. I know I talked to a high-level installation person where I work last week, and they were talking about they're now, even though they're a fee-for-service organization within the organization that I work in and have plenty of money, they've been told they can't hire because they have FTE ceilings. Despite the fact that they have the budget for the positions, they're now managing by FTEs. And so consequently, as they get vacancies in positions that are non-inherently governmental, they're telling me, they're going to capitalize those positions, turn them in, you know, give them over to a inherently governmental function such as security police, and then hire contractors in behind the non-inherently governmental. So it's like a backdoor, and there's no business case analysis being done. There is no, you know, a contractor's cheaper, you know, that kind of stuff. So,
in your experience in your position with the union and with the Department of Defense, have you found any instances where contracting out actually did save the money that it was intended to save?
I have, in my experience, no, but the only the only savings I might have seen would have, or might have been, had access to, would have been the people that cut the grass or something along those lines. Because, you know, where I am, it's, you know, it's seasonal work. So having a full-time employee to cut the grass isn't always necessarily in the best interest of the taxpayer. But, no, I have never found where a contractor did it better than a federal employee or cheaper.
Brian, your thoughts?
Jason, you had mentioned about how much money was supposed to have been saved through contracting out. And I was involved in an A-76 when I was in maintenance at the air station back in 2000, 2001. And in the middle of the process, we had a high-level headquarters Marine Corps deputy commandant for activities and installations came down to our facility to speak to the employees who were involved in this study and gave us a briefing and then asked if anybody had any questions. I was the chief steward at the local at the time, and I raised my hand and I asked him, I said, sir, how much money is the Marine Corps anticipating savings by doing this contracting out? And he said, well, let me clear something up. This is not about saving money. It's about getting out of the business, which I was stunned that a senior management person actually admitted to what really is the agenda. It's not about saving money. It's about getting us out of that business. So we need to get away from, yes, we need to be more efficient, but we know as government employees that we do a better job. We have a commitment. We have the pride in what we do. We're not just there because of that dollar. So that's what it's about.
We're taxpayers too,
right? Exactly.
So, you know, we're paying taxes. We're paying towards our wages. We want to make sure the job's done right.
This is AFGE's Inside Government. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and I'm joined by Don Hale, Patty Viers, and Brian Leonard, all from AFGE. Don, talk about your concerns going forward with contracting out efforts, despite this move by the Army.
Well, you know, there's too many unknowns. We really don't know, you know, what the future is going to hold for contracting out. You know, there's maybe a drawback in our overseas military endeavors, or it may be increased. I mean, you know, who knows what we're going to hear about on the 6 o'clock news. So that's a tough call. But I will say this, that, you know, we should be part of that decision-making process. It shouldn't be done by them, by themselves, unilaterally. Let's have the discussions if it's necessary, and do what's right for the Department of Defense in the future.
All three of you are very involved, obviously, in AFGE's defense conference, but I want to get a sense for some of the things that are happening for you individually at your locals. And Brian, I wanted to start with you. I know that you're pretty busy right now and you have quite a bit on your plate. Could you share some of that with us?
There are a number of ongoing issues that we have police officers in the Marine Corps. We just got them there. The agency's trying to move them to 13.5-hour shifts, changing other working conditions. They shut off my phone lines that they provide me in my contract because they claim I'm not using their equipment, which is something we've had for years. They're messing with us. We also had an incident recently where an assistant fire chief was arrested out in town for some very serious felony drug charges, and they let him come back to work and said he was not charged with any, he wasn't convicted. So, you know, and I told the agency, I said, well, as long as the bargain unit employees are treated the same way for similar circumstances, that's a slippery slope there. So we do have labor management form, and it's a check in the box, like Don was saying. The people I meet with locally, we've been dealing with for years on the traditional labor management grievances, arbitrations, negotiating. And now for them to turn around and say that we're going to be partners and have pre-decisional involvement, it doesn't happen. Our facility is changing over from the F-18s to the F-35, big transition, a lot of impact on our bargaining unit, and I'm lucky to get a briefing once every 6 months. They're not involving us at all, and we've wanted to insert ourselves in that, but they don't like dealing with the union. They don't like dealing with me.
And you have a contract that was agreed upon between you and management. They have a copy of that same contract. Explain to people who may not be familiar with the process or the things that you do how a situation can arise that is in complete violation of the contract but occurs anyway.
It's in most cases, it's in my opinion, it's they willfully violated because they were not the ones that were negotiating it. They didn't like that particular provision. In this particular case with the phone lines, we have had some confrontations with the warrant officer in charge of that particular section, and some employee issues and some bargaining issues. And I believe this is retaliation for that and willful violation of our contract. I've notified the agency that we'll be filing the appropriate charges. That's how we fix our disputes. I've spoken to the agency, given them the opportunity to correct it. But when I was traveling yesterday, here today, I called my phone lines earlier. It still hadn't been fixed. So we'll file the charge, and hopefully that manager will be held accountable.
Patty, I want to come to you for a minute, too. I know that you have a lot happening on your plate. Could you share some of that with us?
Well, Jason, let me remind you, I represent Defense Finance and Accounting Service employees, Defense Logistics Agency employees, Defense Contract Management Agency, and Defense Information Systems Agency. They're all the small components of the Department of Defense. I don't manage any of the – or, I mean, I don't represent any of the big three, Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marine Corps. So in the Defense Finance and Accounting Service right now in Columbus, Ohio, they're trying to, save money. And they've come up with some budget ideas, which they really haven't shared with the union at all. One of the things they want to do is change the hours of duty of employees in order to avoid overtime and comp time, because they don't want to pay that out. Now, that's a bargainable issue for somebody that's not familiar with a contract. If, we agree to hours of duty, so employees, have some idea of when they're expected in and how many hours they can work. And anything above and beyond that is overtime, costs the agency money. But since everybody, the DOD efficiencies have asked the, components to save money, this is one of DFAS's ways of saving money, is to no longer pay overtime and comp time. So we're in the process. I have a bunch of briefings next week with DFAS about that to figure out, if they'd have come to me first, I'm sure we could have figured out another way other than going through this process of bargaining. It would have been nice if we could have been sitting across the table talking about how we could save them money but meet the needs of the employees as well. One of the things good that we are doing in the Defense Logistics Agency right now is we are working on a problem that we're having in a certain area of the country where we have a high positive drug test situation going on. They're working with the union. The agency is trying to figure out how we can tackle that issue. We happen to be the worst in the Department of Defense, actually. So it's a big deal for them. But for me, it's also the issue of getting help for people that, first of all, need jobs. And second, obviously need some other kind of help than what, the process is right now, which is to discipline them first before giving them treatment. So we're working on that. There are good things we're working on. I'm thrilled about that. But again, all of a sudden they want to save money, and it's up to the employees to help them do that, but they don't bring their representatives in or even the employees in and talk to them about it. So, my advice would have been, let's talk about it first.
Don, and I think the last time that we had you on the program, you were dealing with a contracting out situation at West Point, and you got a little bit of help from Congressman Hinchey on that, right?
Correct.
What was the end result there?
Well, we actually had an A-76 study that was overturned. And the other thing that Congressman Hinchey did was he stopped the privatization of our wastewater facility by having a piece of legislation pushed through Congress. So we were successful in both of those endeavors, which was good. If I could... You asked about what was going on at the local level. And a lot of people today don't understand what unions are all about and what we do. But I just want to share with you just a simple story. I work at West Point, and today, as we speak, they're in the midst of a snowstorm. Go figure. We recently brought our security guards in-house. There were contractors. Now they're federal employees. The reason for that is AFGE sued the contractor and we won, and we were forced to bring them back in house. Anyway, now we represent them. Somebody in their ultimate wisdom today told the security guards, first of all, they can't have any heaters outside and they're not allowed to wear winter clothing. Now, it's snowing. Snow. That means it's cold. And the security guards, because some dingbat supervisor wants to play hardball with them, and I'm in D.C. and he can get away with it, so he thinks, is having them tell them that they can't wear proper clothing. How ridiculous is that? So when people say, what do you do as a union activist? I'm going to make sure that them security guards are able to wear warm clothing. I'm going to make sure that they have heaters available to them. We're not going to obstruct anything. We're going to help those people that need help.
Don Hale, AFGE DEFCON chair, Patty Viers, vice chair, and Brian Leonard, Marine Corps Council president. All three of you, thank you so much for joining us today. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll be joined by Ron Pollack, the executive director of Families USA, who will talk to us a little bit about the one-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and I'm joined now by Ron Pollack, Families USA Executive Director. Ron, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
This week marked the one-year anniversary of President Obama signing the Affordable Care Act into law. How has the implementation of the law progressed?
Well, really well is the short answer. There are many provisions that are already in effect, and they're helping a good number of folks. For young adults, they can stay on their parents' policy until their 26th birthday. Seniors who have this real problem in terms of their prescription drug coverage under Medicare and are worried that they fall into this big gap of coverage called the donut hole. Last year, people who fell into that gap received a $250 check. This year, they are receiving a 50% discount on their brand name drugs. Small business owners are receiving tax credits up to 35% of the cost of providing coverage for their workers so that it is more affordable for them to continue to do so. Children who have pre-existing conditions like asthma or diabetes, they no longer can be denied coverage due to a pre-existing condition. Companies have been provided help so that they can provide coverage for their early retirees between the ages of 55 and 64. Community health centers have received substantial amounts of money that enable them to add coverage, care for people. They'd expected to serve 18 million people this year. Now it looks like they can serve 29 million people. Insurance companies can no longer rescind your insurance policy just because you get sick or you have an accident. There no longer are lifetime limits on the benefits you receive. So if you have a major illness, you're not going to be bankrupted. Insurance companies have to now spend a larger portion of the premium dollar on health benefits for people rather than marketing and advertising and administrative costs and profits. And insurance commissions have received extra money so that they can do a better job of reviewing proposed increases in premiums than insurance companies would like to establish. And as a result, a number of the proposed increases in a variety of states, insurance companies were asked to go back to the drawing board and have rescinded or dropped significant portions of their proposed increases. So there's a lot of stuff that's already in effect, and it's helping millions of people.
With all of these things in effect, you would think that the reception would be all positive, but there are some, particularly in the House of Representatives, who are interested in scaling back or even a full repeal. How likely is something like that?
It's not going to happen. There's going to be a lot of noise, but this is all partisan politics right now. And as Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, has said in a speech he gave to the Heritage Foundation, my number one, number two, number three priorities is to make President Obama a one-term president. Well, that's part of what this is all about. But the reality is these efforts to repeal the legislation, to defund it, they're not going to happen. They won't pass the Senate. And in any event, President Obama would not sign them into law.
Do you think it's possible that the defunding piece has a little bit of traction to it because the Republican majority in the House, or is that something that really wouldn't stand a chance either?
I don't think that's going to pass either. You know, the president has made clear that, you know, he's willing to work with Republicans about the overall budget, and he wants to do things to make sure that the deficit is lowered and we get our budget house in order. But these things like defunding the Affordable Care Act, this is not a budget item. Remember, the Congressional Budget Office has told us that the overall cost of this legislation is it saves money because it creates a whole lot of efficiencies in America's healthcare system. And Congressional Budget Office estimated that it will reduce the deficit in the first 10 years by about $130 billion, and in the next decade by over $1 trillion. So this is really not a serious effort at good budgeting. This is really ideology and politics. So I don't think it's going to pass.
This is AFGE's Inside Government. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and I'm speaking with Ron Pollack, Families USA's executive director, about the one-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. Ron, earlier you mentioned a great point about spending caps. Could you talk a little bit about a little bit more about those spending caps?
Well, if you have a major illness, or you've got a you're in an accident, one of the things many people don't know about their insurance policies, because it's part of the fine print, is that there may be a cap on how much the insurance company is going to pay out. And those caps, some of them are about $1 million, but they're life, you know, these are often lifetime caps. And so if you have a major illness, you're at great risk of at some point reaching that cap, and then you're totally out on your own. Despite the fact that you bought insurance for many years, you have to pay for all the costs out of your own pocket. And this is what drives people into bankruptcy. These lifetime caps have come to an end already, and now we're phasing in the end of annual caps. So that if you have a major illness in a particular year, the annual cap is not going to force you to spend significant amounts of money out of pocket. Now, there's one other thing that's about the Affordable Care Act that goes into effect in 2014. Namely, there are new protections for people that they don't have to spend more than a certain amount of money for health care services when they receive them. For most people, for an individual, they'll never have to spend more than about $6,000 in out-of-pocket costs. For family, $12,000. But if you are a moderate-income person or family, it's even less than that. And right now, there are no such protections. So these are going to be new protections. So not only will people get tax credit subsidies to enable them to afford premiums, starting in 2014. They will also get protections in terms of the out-of-pocket costs that they bear when they get health care services.
That seems to be significant because a lot of times personal bankruptcies are spurred on by a major medical illness. Is that right?
Yes. The largest single cause of people going bankrupt today has to do with medical costs. And the majority of those folks actually have health insurance. They may hit up against a lifetime or an annual cap. For many, some of the other out-of-pocket costs, between the deductibles and copays, at some point people feel they can't afford those costs. So these new protections are very important. Not only will people have a better chance of affording premiums because they'll get the tax credit subsidies, but they won't have to bear such a large cost when they actually receive care.
One of the major concerns about health care in America is the escalating cost, and every year it continues to increase. Will the Affordable Care Act bring down the cost of health care in this country?
It's certainly going to moderate, though, costs. Remember, costs have been rising very rapidly, much faster than inflation, much faster than wages. Without the passage of health reform, that would just continue. There are a number of efficiencies that are brought about by this legislation that should moderate increases in the future. I'm not going to say to you that there won't be increases in the future. There probably will be. But I think the same kinds of increases that we've seen for many years running, I think we're going to see real moderation with that. A greater portion of the premium dollar will now be spent on actually health care services for people rather than marketing and advertising, administrative costs, profits. That's going to make the health care system more efficient. The payments to hospitals and other providers will now be predicated on quality of care rather than quantity of services. And there's going to be a whole lot more coordination of care. You know, if you've got multiple health problems, it would be good to be working with a team of doctors rather than separately going to see this specialist and that specialist. And one specialist might be prescribing drugs for you that actually cause harm to you for other health conditions that another doctor is treating. As we have better coordinated care, it's going to improve quality, and it's going to mean that some of the redundant services you receive or services that are not helpful to you, presumably they will be minimized.
And how does the Affordable Care Act enable small businesses in America to provide health care for their employees?
Well, it does so in two main ways. First, already in effect, are tax credit subsidies to small businesses. These are small businesses that have fewer than 25 employees. They can receive tax credits up to 35% of their costs of providing coverage for their workers. That percentage will increase later on. In addition to that, and perhaps at least as important, small businesses will be able to join these new healthcare marketplaces. So instead of just bargaining on their own, in which they don't really have much leverage, they will be able to join with other small businesses in order to get a better price and get a better deal. And I think that's going to make healthcare coverage more affordable for them in the future.
Ron Pollack, Executive Director of Families USA. As always, Ron, thank you for your time.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you to our guests this week, MSNBC's Ed Schultz, AFGE DEFCON Chair Don Hale, Vice Chair Patty Vyers, Marine Corps Council President Brian Leonard, and Families USA Executive Director Ron Pollack. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.